right, so we should go ahead and get started. You guys had a nice weekend. So a few words. Somebody asked if they could say a couple of things about the SPS. Maybe they wanted to say the first thing. You should be aware that the Society of Physics students has held hours most evenings in the POA library, and I'm sure the senior students so feel free to take advantage of that. It's a good thing. In addition, Inga is free to give an office hour. So Wednesdays, 2 to 3 p.m. in Gossamer 477 to be able to talk about important things. Mayor will also schedule one that isn't connected to her as a time yet. And again, I have an office hour, but don't feel limited by that. If you want to meet, send me an email, and we'll try to set up a meeting. That said, I'll try to read the email. So basically, one last night, set up a meeting by the subject line. I didn't think it was that. I thought it was something that's going to require me to sit down and think for a few minutes, and so I didn't actually open the email. So anyway, hopefully that won't be an issue. So let me ask, does anybody have any questions or issues with the course overall? Workshops happened yesterday. No, yes. Yeah.
Question about the mayor.
Okay.
What is his last name?
Anissa, and it's a she.
Oh, okay.
Yes?
I still don't have my book. It's not ordered from the bookstore, and there aren't any copies in the library.
I will put a copy on reserve in the library today.
Okay.
I stole it last.
Yeah,
I didn't have a copy. and I needed to make out your problem set. And I thought I could use the one from last time, but I thought it was probably a good idea if I actually read through the problems again and made sure they were appropriate before I made out the problem set. What happened, apparently a year or two ago, we were short, and the TAs, I wasn't teaching 142 anymore, but the TAs needed copies, so they came in and took my copies, and I never got them back, and I didn't realize it until I was sitting down to make out the problem set. And so I went and asked Janet, and Janet says, oh, I've ordered books, but we don't have any, so I went to the library and took the copy out of there. So I will try to make a point of putting it back up there this afternoon. If you don't find it, make a point of sending me a nasty email. And I'll try to. But I right now have two copies because I managed to get a copy earlier today. So, anything else? Yes?
Do labs begin this week or next for lab A?
I don't know. Anybody know? When do labs begin, lab A?
Next week.
All right. Is there another hand up? I thought. Nope. All right. Okay, so last time we spent a good bit of time on quarks, of all things. But for this course, what we really talked a bit about was Coulomb's Law. And I wanted to sort of pursue that and then talk about electric fields a bit more today. So, as we've sort of seen, there is a force between particles. We say that particles feel this force, have something which is called electric charge. It is a repulsive and attractive force, so the simplest way we can mathematically model that is to think of the charge coming in two different types, positive and negative, we call it. So we have Coulomb's law that describes this force. It's a vector force. There's a number here which sort of sets the scale and the units of the force. We have quantities of charge in MKS, it's Coulombs. It has a direction which is along the line between the two forces. It's a vector force. When they are opposite charges, this is a minus sign, and if we look at the force of this big Q on little q, If it's minus, the little cube is this way, so opposite charges attract. If they have same sign, then they repel. And it goes as inverse square of the distance. And just to make sure we're all on the same page, if I write this without a vector sign, it could mean one of two things. One is that I intend to write the magnitude of the vector squared, and the other is that I forgot to put the arrow on top. So you have to look in context and sort of figure it out. Of course, if I do the square, then if it's actually vectors, then I wouldn't use that notation. I'd use a dot product or a cross product or something. At any rate, so that's what happens if you have a single discrete charge. If you have multiple charges, then it's really just you do a vector sum of the forces. So the force on little q, if, for example, I have little q here, and I have sort of a big Q1 over here, which is at a distance, which has a, is whose distance and direction from little q is given by vector R1. I could have a Q2 over here, and that's just a charge, not a vector, but it could be at position like so. And I could have R2 there, and so forth, all the way to, I don't want to put Q in there because I'm going to put an equation there, so I'll put Q in over here. So I have some N charges, and because this is a vector, each charge adds independently. That is, we have what we know as vector superposition of the forces. If each of these charges acts on little q independently, it's just like having a box with the multiple strings pulling it, and you do a vector sum just like you did in mechanics. So the force on little q is equal to the force of q1 on Q, vector summed with the force of Q2 on Q, plus the force of Q sub n on little q. And of course, we can rewrite that a little bit more compactly. So, okay, it's just a sum over each of these force terms where you have to take into account the direction as well as the distance for each of these forces and have them get a vector. Okay, you all right with that? So that's how we deal with discrete charges. Most of the time, actually, things of interest aren't easily broken down into discrete charges. Usually, they're continuous charge distribution. So if we look at F on Q from a continuous charge distribution, this is sort of where the fun starts. So let us imagine that we have a coordinate system, Cartesian system, and for generality, we'll just put Q at some random point over here. So there's little Q, and little Q is its position in space is given by this vector, which we'll call R-sub-Q. Okay, out in three space. And now we're going to have some random potato continuous distribution of charge, okay? Fully could be three-dimensional, could be very complicated. It doesn't have to have an even distribution of the charge. It could be extremely complex. Okay, so this is a general charge distribution. And now we got a problem. So I don't know how to do the vector sum over that. So I have to think about this a little bit. So the way to think about it is, if you're faced with this problem and you had not invented calculus, you would need to invent calculus right now. Because the problem is this isn't discrete. So we don't know how to deal with it. So the way to deal with it and the way to do all continuous problems is to make it discrete, actually. So the way to do that is to not consider this entire distribution. All right? What I want to do instead is to consider one little, tiny, little piece of it. This piece is so tiny that regardless of how the charge distribution is changing as you go across this full continuous distribution, in that little spot, it's not changing. It's just a little fixed charge. Okay, that's the way to think about it. So you ignore for a moment that you have this big Mongo distribution of product here, okay? And you just think about this little tiny thing that is so small. We call it a differential to signify that it is in the limit that across that particular little piece, nothing's changing, right? I can think of it as a fixed charge. It isn't a real charge in the real world, okay? I'm inventing this so that I can do a calculation. So I signify that by the fact that it's a little thing by putting a little d. So it's a dq, okay? It's a little differential charge. And if I consider only that little differential charge, then I can do something with it. First of all, it is located at some position which I'm given, which I will signify by vector r, okay? And then I can look at the distance and direction between this little d cube and the point q by looking at this vector. All right? And that vector is the difference between rq and r. So it's just the difference between those vectors. Now, in terms of that last vector I drew, we now have a discrete charge that is given by that vector relative to little q. And now I know how to write down the force due to that. The force on q from dq, you write just how we've written so far, except you can't say it's a full force because it's only a teeny tiny little force due to this teeny tiny little charge. So I have to... The force on q which is due to dq isn't the force on q. It is just a little contribution to the force on q from this little charge. So I signify that by calling it a df. And that is going to be k times little q times the other charge, which is dq, divided by the distance between them squared, which is the magnitude of this vector squared, and along a direction, which is this difference vector hat. You okay with that? So it mentally when you see the continuous distribution, you should likely find it daunting. Then just relax, take a tiny little piece of it, and treat it exactly how you would have treated a discrete charge. Just bear in mind that you have that little piece and make sure you have your differentials correct, okay? Once you've got that, then all you have to do, here's the fun part, all you have to do is to take this expression and now sum it up vectorially over all the infinite number of little dq's that are all around this space, okay? Each dq has a different vector r. Each dq could have a different magnitude because the charge distribution as a whole could be changing across this thing. And you have to sum them up. This vector is changing as well as you go to each of these parts, okay? A sum of little differentials over a continuous thing is what we know of as an integral. So now, to do this, you have to integrate both sides of this thing over the charge distribution. For most charge distributions, that's going to be ridiculously hard to impossible. But there are certain geometries where it's just not so bad. If that not so bad is what's going to make your life miserable the rest of the semester, because you're going to get really good at those ones that are sort of doable by mere mortals. Okay?
Really, really good.
And it's not quite as bad as it sounds, because you're going to get really good over looking at things over arc lengths and lines and spheres and stuff like that. And interestingly enough, you can you can take a lot of arbitrary shapes and actually sort of approximate them in terms of lines and spheres and arc lengths and things. So it's not quite as limiting as it seems. If you think about, if you look at a circuit, it's made up of lots of line segments often. You know? So it's not that it's completely useless. It's actually pretty useful. But whether this is easy or hard depends a whole lot on how this is set up. Mathematically, this could be doable. Mathematically, it could be just impossible. So, to get the total force on Q, and now I'm not saying from dq, I'm saying the total vector force on Q, right? I do an integral over the volume of df, which is equal to the integral over the volume of KQ dq okay. Okay, so that is fundamentally how you would do any charge distribution. You don't generally actually sum up dq's in that way, all right? Because what you usually are given is some sort of geometry. That is, you know something about the volume. And then the dq's are given to you by some sort of mathematical function as to how does the charge distribute across that volume. Right, so that's usually what you're integrating is not dq directly, but dq as a function of how it's distributed in the volume, and you're integrating actually over the spatial volume. All right. So you want to take out your coder ring, because generally speaking, if we have a 3D volume, then dq is equal to rho d dv, where rho is a function of this r. So what I'm saying is I have a charge density and that charge density varies as a function of where you are in the volume. Okay, so this little dq is equal to rho times dv, where dv is the differential volume that I'm considering there, and rho is the three-dimensional charge density at that point defined by that vector. As this vector changes around, rho is a function that mathematically may change. It could be that it doesn't change. Okay? It could be a problem where rho is constant. And you'll love those because you can just pull rho out of the integral and life is easy. But not always. Okay? And the ones that you'll remember are the ones where it doesn't pull out. So, rho has units of coulombs per meter cubed. Okay? Now, I say pull out your decoder ring because if we do a 2D surface, you think of it in the same way, except we call it sigma. And usually the differential is, say, a differential in the area. So this could be, for example, I have charge residing on the surface of a sphere or the surface of a potato. It doesn't matter. And now I have on this thing my charge distribution. I could have, you know, some sort of weird charge distribution. And the way to think of it is I now have a little differential area, dA. And the amount of differential charge that that represents is going to be this sigma, which is a mathematical function describing how the charge is distributed around this potato, okay, times dA, whatever it is. Could have a line charge distribution. Don't take line seriously. It could be a some sort of a one-dimensional. It could be a one-dimensional thing, but it could curve. Okay, so I could have some sort of distribution on a wire that looks like that. Okay. And now I cannot consider, this is in coulombs per meter squared. This sigma is going to be in coulombs per meter squared here. So along this line, I can't think of volume, I can't think of area, I have to think of a differential line length, okay? So usually, we call that something like a DS. If it truly is a line, maybe you call it a DL or something like that. But often we call it DS because you're literally thinking about a little bit of an arc length or something. And now the DQ is equal to, instead of rho or sigma, we usually use a lambda. And it'll be times dx. Okay? I say pull out your decoder rings because these conventions are pretty well set. If you see a problem and it's a little bit ambiguous what the exact geometry is, if they give you the charge distribution in sigma, chances are really good they're talking about a surface charge distribution. All right, so I wouldn't integrate over the full volume of the sphere. I would worry about the surface of it, okay? If it's a lambda, it's a line. If it's a row, it's a volume. Okay, these are very well set conventions. That said, of course, it's just a symbol and it could be anything, right? So you need to pay some attention to what you're doing. But I would have to be in a truly perverse mood to give you an exam problem where I give you an area and then define the symbol in terms of a row or something. That would be you would be, by all rights, I think it'd be quite fair for you to just pummel me up in front of this.
just any judge would call it justifiable, I think. So if they'd ever had physics, it wouldn't be an issue. These are pretty set conventions. Okay.
Any questions? All right, so the charge could be distributed in any of these ways. What you call it and what you integrate over, you have it. So whether it's hard or easy depends on the nature of the problem.
The actual geometry. Okay. So we're going to do an example in a few minutes, but I'd like to continue on something that we started talking about at the start of class, at the end of class last time, which is so I have some charge Q over here, and I have this little Q that we've been talking about, and perhaps they're related by this, they're separated by this vector R. You know, it's really fair to ask what causes the force. And last time we just invented something, all right?
So we're going to sort of stick with that theme for a little while. So what we're going to say is that big Q does something to the space around it. And what we're going to say is that it creates an electric field. All right? So we're just, you to remember this, all right? We are totally pulling this out of thin air. We're going to say that the charge does something to the space around it,
and it creates an electric field. Okay? And I'm going to define the electric field I'll call it E. We'll say it's a vector, and E is equal to the force per unit charge that the little charge Q would feel at that particular point.
There's a correlation between
the F and the E in the sense that you have to be talking about the same point in space.
Alright? So it's not hard.
We would say that but notice that what I'm doing is I'm basically factoring out the magnitude of this thing.
Okay, and really I'm translating that into a way of talking about the condition in space at that point rather than the charge at that point by saying it's the force per unit charge. In order to say that I have a force, I have to put a specific charge there and calculate it. But if I say, what is the force per unit charge, the magnitude of that charge has just been factored out. I can put any charge I want there. It doesn't matter. All I have to do is now. So we call this arbitrary charge that you might put to detect the electric field at some point, mentally, of course, we call it a test charge. Okay? Conventionally, you take the direction of the electric field as the direction that you would have on a positive test charge. Okay.
So if I have a charge Q here and I consider some point P up here, I would say that the electric field at point P is equal to K times Q times, let us imagine I put a little positive test charge at that point, then I would multiply it by the magnitude of that, divide it by this vector R, if you wish. Okay? But it's the electric field, so what I've written here is the force. So to get the electric field, I divide this by Q. And so I end up with K big Q R hat over R squared. So what I have is a quantity now that has direction, it has magnitude, but it has no dependence on what I might put at that point in space. Okay? And that's sort of the power of it. I now only need to consider the charge big Q, and I ask, what is it doing to the space around it? I can always figure out what the force is if I know the electric field, because all I have to do is pop a little test charge in there, or a charge of whatever magnitude I want to worry about the force being on. Okay, and I can pop that in there and I can calculate the force. So we haven't actually lost any information. It's not obvious we've gained much, but it turns out this is very powerful because it allows us to now only consider the effect of this one thing. I don't have to know about the other thing. You okay with that? Okay, so now, you're going to need to get pretty comfortable with electric fields and visualizing it, because most of the time, if you have a charge distribution, you need to be thinking. You will often have to be thinking and calculating electric fields in this class. Is the electric field real? I will remind you how it was just created. Right? Okay, just remember that. By the end of the class, I think you'll believe in this as something being very real. But we just pulled it out of thin air as a calculational convenience, and we will see what we think about it later on. Okay? You will want to learn to think of it as being very real, because you're going to need to build a mental model of it. So it's really not so bad. If I have some charge Q right here, and I want to create a visualization of the electric field, let's say that this has a positive charge, then I can mentally put a little test charge right here. What's the electric field going to look like? Well, it's going to be, if it's a positive test charge and I have a positive big Q, I know it would be pointing radially away from big Q. So I can picture it as something like this. If I consider a point P out here, it's along the same line of action, but it's now a good bit further away. And remember, the magnitude of this thing falls off as 1 over R squared. If I look at the magnitude of the force, the magnitude of the force divided by a little Q, so the field drops off also as 1 over R squared. Okay? So this will be in the same direction, but much shorter. If I have point P up here, it's going to be like so. If I have it over here, it's going to be like so. If I have it over here, it's going to be like so. Right? So you can visualize it. Things can become a little more complex. If I have a negative charge, you go through the same thinking, except now if I have a little test charge I put here, by convention, test charge always positive, so the field would be that direction. Like so. Right, so you can mentally figure out what the field ought to look like. Remember, it's a vector superposition. The force is always a vector superposition of whatever else is out there. So the field is also the same thing. It's a vector field. So that means if I have it coming from different places, I just superimpose those vectorially, and it adds together vectorially. Okay. So mentally, that means if I have a plus Q here and a minus Q here, for example, and I now put a test charge, say, right here in the middle, that test charge is going to be repelled by this Q and attracted by that Q, so the field will be like so. If I put a test charge up here, it's going to be repelled a little by the positive charge. It'll be attracted a little by the negative charge. Those two things, force-wise, now add together vectorially, right? And so the up and down components of these two totally cancel out, and the right side, the piece of these that are pointing to the right from your perspective, adds together. So I end up with a field that does something like that. If I'm over here, I'm repelled by the positive, I'm attracted by the negative, but the negative is closer. So I'm going to have a field that does that. Over here, it's going to do that. Over here, it's going to do that. All right, so you can begin to sense what's going to happen. I can sort of draw what we call lines of force. By lines of force, and these are not drawn perfectly, obviously, they represent the electric field, how the electric field would be at any tangent to the line. They can't cross because wherever I put this test charge, it's going to, if there are multiple things on it, they add vectorially, so you have one net force. You can't have multiple directions for the electric field at a given point. So the electric field here, for example, is tangent, like so. Okay, these lines of force. So you want to learn to visualize them. And so here are a few standard geometries.
You can't see the arrows. This is positive, so these are all pointing out. These are two positive charges, and so if I put something in the middle, they both are repelling it. Vectorially, it cancels out, so you actually have zero force on that point. But if you're out here, you're going away. So the field lines would look like this for same sign dipole, or same sign two charge distribution. If you have opposite sign dipole, then it looks like what we just drew, except maybe better. Okay, any questions on that?
So on the class website, we have one of these Java applets where what we do is it shows the electric field that surrounds this particle. If I increase the charge on the particle, the electric field gets stronger. And if the particle's moving, you can think of the electric field as being a dynamic sort of thing, okay? If the particle is negative, same sort of thing, but now the field's reversed. If I have multiple particles, the electric field is the vector superposition of the field you would expect from the two particles. if I have sort of a charged dipole, now you begin to get the picture that we had in the other that we made, okay? I can show the field lines for just the orange, or just the blue, or all of them. Okay, I can add a third particle if you want. So things can become very complicated, but you can play with this applet if you want. Again, it's particularly good at late night frat parties, probably. All right. So a few lines of force rules, because you'll often want to sort of make drawings that use these. By convention, they go from plus to minus. They have to, because we define the test charge to be positive. So you'd be repelled from the plus, attracted to the minus. The lines never cross, because to do so you would have a point where you would have a net force which is in two different directions simultaneously, so that's not going to work. My drawing, it wasn't so obvious, but here the density of the lines gives you a strength of the electric field. So the density is proportional to, so when I do a little alpha, unless we start doing something with nuclear physics, it means proportional to in this class, is proportional to the magnitude of E, and the force on any particle, any test particle that you put there, and the field itself are always tangent to the line of force. Any questions? Okay. So let us imagine, what would you expect to happen if you have an electric field that looks like this, and now you begin to see, okay? I have just talked about a condition in space, and I've defined it, but I haven't had to say anything about how it got there. We have an electric field in space that is uniform and pointing to the right. Okay? So that's actually a powerful thing. We've really divorced this whole weird force that we're dealing with, and we've divorced it from the charges in a sense. Very often it will be associated with charges in a problem, but you can also now consider it independent of what may cause it. Because there's probably an infinite number of ways to actually create that particular condition in space. Okay. You have charges in all sorts of weird distributions and create that electric field. So that's not a complication in this problem. So let us suppose that we have now some sort of material in this which is slightly polarizable. That is, you can move the charge a little bit. What's going to happen to this material? If I have an electric field in that material, the electric field is going to exert a force on the positive charge that pushes it a little bit along the field. It's going to pull the negative charge a little bit. So I'll tend to get a little bit of separation of charge, like so. Okay? the force on this one is like that, the forces on that is like this, and what will happen if I have a piece that's sort of lined up like this is it will tend to orient itself along the line of the force. You good with that? All right. So what I have here is a piece of plastic that has a bunch of little beads inside it in a liquid. The beads you can think of as being like that little piece of material. And then I have a device here which deposits charge of opposite sign on the two metal pieces here and here. So you can think of these as sort of two point charge. And right now, you see that I have a pretty random distribution of these little beads. Okay? And if I now deposit charge on these two pieces, you'll begin to see these things move. Note they're lining up along what you would visualize as the lines of charge. The lines of force. These things that are closer, they get lined up like so. In the middle, they're sort of lined up between them. As you go farther away, you begin to get this picture that's very similar to what we were drawing. Do the same thing, but now I'm going to use two plates. What's it going to look like? What's it going to look like between the plates? Should be a straight line. Let's see what happens. Now you see you're getting more or less straight lines going up and down between the plates, but notice as you get to the edge of the plates, you have sort of this bulging. Right, so the edge effects are real, but this would be sort of a model of what we call a parallel plate capacitor. So the geometry is very simple if you're in the middle, but if you get near the edges in the real world, it's getting more complicated. Field lines running radially between the circles, largely. And then lots of weird things outside of that stick. That's might look pretty interesting on this one. Cool, huh? So whether the field is real or not, you can certainly think of it that way. Okay? It's a very useful tool, for sure. And you want to be thinking, sort of create a mental mechanical picture of electric fields and stuff in your head for a lot of these problems. Because, I mean, sometimes it will really help you understand what's going on. Partly why we start off with mechanics and physics instead of electromagnetism, and often why many students initially think electromagnetism is harder,
is because in mechanics, it's easier to visualize the mechanical model thing. In electromagnetism, you have to sort of develop your own mental model. But once you do that, I think you'll find that it's certainly no harder than mechanics in that sense. Okay, any questions? All right, so very often we won't actually be worrying about forces that we'll be calculating. We'll actually look at, for example, the electric field of a discrete charge. So if we say we have a discrete charge Q, and we ask what is the electric field at point P out here, which is at a distance, a position given by vector R, then we know that the force of Q at P, if I put a little test charge there, would be K, big Q, little q, R hat over R squared. So the electric field due to big Q at point P is going to be K, Q over R squared, R hat. If we have a system of discrete charges, so let us say we now have a point P here, and we have a Q1 over here, a Q2 over here, a Qn over here, then we would say that the force at point P on Q, if we were to put a test charge there, would be equal to the sum of K times each Q sub I times the test charge magnitude times the vector direction for each I term divided by the magnitude squared of the distance for each of the I terms. You sum them up. The electric field at point P due to n Qs, okay, is going to be the same thing with the test charge magnitude divided out. So it's going to be the vector sum of the K, Q sub I, R sub I hat over R sub I squared. Sum victorious. You okay with that? I mean, this is simpler in some ways, right? Because I don't have the little Q that I have to worry about. Just have to worry about the big Qs. But of course, life is more interesting than that. Typically what we have is some annoying random charge distribution out here. And it's continuous. And we may want to ask, what is the electric field at some random point P over here? And the way to think about that is just like we thought about it in terms of forces. What you want to do is to not think of this as being a big random continuous charge distribution initially. You want to think of it as a bunch of discrete charges. Okay? In fact, let me ignore all of it and just think of one discrete charge in the middle of this thing. But it has to now be a differential charge because this is a continuous distribution. And if I consider anything bigger than a differential, it could be changing. So I have a little dq here. And we'll say that that dq that I've chosen happens to be defined in a position by this vector r. R sub p happens to be defined, this is a point p, by the vector r sub p here. And now I can look at the position of r sub p, the position of point p where I'm trying to look at the electric field relative to this little differential charge that I've chosen.
And this vector is R sub P minus R, which in this case I'm just going to define as an R prime for simplicity, not an R1, an R prime. I'm going to say that this is a some rho sub R, so that's the charge distribution I'm given. And now the differential electric field at point P is going to be the expression that I would use for a single charge, which we have here, except instead of Q now, I'm going to use dQ, and I have to use the appropriate vectors. So this is going to be K times dQ in the direction of this little R prime hat divided by R prime squared. Okay? And then if I want to know the total electric field at point P, then I integrate over the charge distribution K dQ R prime hat over R prime squared. And that gives me the full vector field. Part integral, because you've got, as you integrate over this, this vector is changing in magnitude and direction. So you can't necessarily pull this stuff out of the integral, right? It's changing as you move around. So it can be particularly difficult if, in fact, as we are here, given a function that defines how the charge density changes as you move around, you can go ahead and put that in here. So we can rewrite this as the integral over the charge of K rho of R prime dV times R prime hat over R prime squared. Okay? So that's sort of fundamentally a very important expression. It's practically sort of useless because it really depends on the geometry. That's where all the usefulness will come in. So any fundamental questions about this? All right. So I think to make this sink in well, what I'd like to do is a concrete example of this sort of thing so you can see how it works. So let's do something with a fairly simple geometry. So we're just going to say, let's have a line segment. I will put the center of the line segment at 0. Let's say that it is a minus L to plus L in terms of its length. So L, 2L is the length of this line segment. Let's take a point P, which is directly above the midpoint of this line. And we're going to say that this line segment carries a uniform charge distributed along. So the problem might be written like something sort of, might be phrased like, find the electric field at a point P, a distance Z, above the midpoint of a line segment of length 2L, which carries a uniform line charge of lambda.
Okay? I'm sure you're touched at the beauty of the prose. Scientific papers suck because you have to be so specific about so many things. You have no room for ambiguity, so it's just truly a horrible way to write.
That said, we now have the problem in front of us. So what's the first thing you might think about doing? Yeah.
Write the integral that we have to use.
You could write the integral that you have to use, and we should do that. But I think what I try to do first is to actually just picture. Because very often the integral that you have to write depends a lot on the symmetries of the problem. In fact, this is sort of the first example. You will be doing test problems and stuff where the actual answer might be, by symmetry, boop, 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 boop is true. That's actually a valid argument in this business. Okay, so let us look at this for a moment and think about the symmetry that's involved and then ponder what integral it is that we'd like to actually write. Okay, so in this case, if we look at this, here's our line segment, here's our point, and the thing that you might notice is that if I have positive charge distributed across here, which we'll just assume positive, I don't tell you, but let's assume positive, then the stuff over here is going to be pushing you off that way, the stuff over here is going to be pushing you off that way, and the sideways pieces of that, by symmetry, basically have to cancel out, right? All right, so to be a little more formal than that, if we consider a little dq over here, which is equal to lambda times, I'll call it a dl here, since we're talking about a line segment, for every little dq that I have to the left-hand side of that midpoint, I have an equivalent dq on the right-hand side. And the one on the left-hand side is going to be pushing me like so, and the one on the right-hand side is going to be pushing me like so. And so by symmetry, this piece and that piece have to cancel out. And I'm left with 2 times this piece, basically. Those add together. So instead of integrating this thing from minus L to plus L, I can integrate from 0 to L, multiply it by 2, and only consider the upward component. Okay? Sort of by symmetry of the problem. So I think it's useful to at least ponder that before you just jump into the math initially. Okay, just get a mental feel for what is the symmetry of the problem and is there a way to try to simplify it. All right, so now let's sort of jump into the math. Here's my line segment, minus L to L. I have this point P, which is going to be a distance z up above.
And if I consider that I have a little dq, say somewhere over here, that little dq will be a distance r from point P. I can define a vector that way if I want. And let's say that I'll call this distance x. And I sort of pull that distance out of the air because if I look at this geometry, I know that I want to sum up the little dq's along this line. So I'm thinking I likely want to do the integral along that line segment. You could imagine doing the integral of angles as you change the angle. And this is a decision you'll have to make on a problem-by-problem basis. It's like, what do I want to integrate over? Because that defines now how you're doing all your math and everything. And I can guarantee you that for most of these problems, there's going to be an easier way to do it and a much harder to slash impossible way to do it, or many of them. And you get to learn how to figure that out. So in this one, it sort of screams, I'd like to add up these little line segments. But for every little line segment, z may be fixed, but this r, this distance, and the direction all changes. So I have to take that into account. But I'm thinking I probably want to put this in terms of z and x instead of r. So let's ponder that for a minute. If I look at this particular dq, it's going to give me a field which is going to sort of be in this direction. So that would be dE at point P due to that dq. And now instead of dl, I'll call it dx because I've defined x to be that line. And if I call this theta, then this is theta, and I'm going to take this and make it bigger. What I've discovered is that this piece, which is dEP sine theta, I don't care about, because for every little dq I have over here, I have a dq over here that cancels that piece out. So I don't have to think about that at all. So this goes away by symmetry. This I do have to worry about, and this is dEP times the cosine of the angle. And that angle is going to change as I move this. Okay? So now we write down the integral that we sort of looked at the situation. I want a black integral, not a red integral. Okay, so the integral, the electric field at point P, I know is the integral over this charge distribution of K times all the little dQs over R squared times R hat. Or, that's the integral, I will say it is 2 by using the symmetry. Instead of integrating from minus L to L, I'm going to integrate over dx. I'm going to go from 0 to L, and it's going to be K. Instead of dq, I'm going to call it lambda dx, because that's my differential little charge. And over r squared, I want this cosine theta component of it only. So when I use this, I'm projecting out only that component by symmetry. So I'm going to put cosine theta, and I know it's in theta, not x right now, so I have to figure that one out. I'm not there yet. Times r hat.
Or another way to say it is, yeah, so EP is the sum of the differential EP times cosine theta, if you want to think of it that way. Yes?
If we have it in that form, if we take the R hat as the original R, we're not going to have the pure differential.
Well, we can't take this R hat as the original R, because it's changing as I change, for each dx.
I'm saying the resum up from 0 to L, or whichever half, it's not going to be the vertical.
Well, the cosine theta times R hat is projecting out the vertical component. How do I say this? Magnitude-wise, we're projecting out the vertical component. At the end, we know we've projected out the vertical component by the symmetry, so we basically know that this gives us an answer in the Z. Okay.
You're right. Actually, I wrote it wrong. I'm sorry for arguing with you. I know that this is now in the z-hat direction. We are only summing up. By putting the cosine theta in there, we are summing up only the z-hat component. Okay? All right. So now what I'd like to do is to change all these things into x and z. So in particular, cosine theta R is equal to x squared plus z squared to the 1/2, the magnitude of it, right? And so cosine theta is going to be the adjacent, that would be z, over the hypotenuse, which is R. So cosine theta is equal to z over x squared plus z squared to the 1/2. And now I substitute that in. So E sub p is equal to 2k. Lambda in this case is constant, so I can pull it out. I could easily change this problem by making lambda have a function instead of being constant. Right? Goes from 0 to L of K. Well, I've already got K out. I want cosine theta, so that's Z over X squared plus Z squared to the 1/2 times DX over R squared, which is X squared plus Z squared. So this is 2k lambda times the integral from 0 to L of z dx over x squared plus z squared to the 3/2. Okay? And if you've had a calculus class, and this is all in the z hat direction. If you had a calculus class, then you just do this integral. If it's been a while, you look it up in the table. Generally speaking, I'm not going to give you really fabulously hard integrals, and I will make them available in a table on an exam or whatever, but you may have to look it up. All right, so in this case, when you do the integral, you end up with EP is equal to x over z squared times x squared plus z squared to the 1/2. Between the limits of 0 and L in the z-hat direction. And you now evaluate it between those limits, and you end up with 2k lambda zL over z squared, L squared plus z squared to the 1/2 in the z-hat direction. Okay, so the next step, and you're not done, how do you know this is right? You put a test charge, it's going to go in the z-hat direction, which is good. But how else do you know you're right?
Check units.
Check units. That would be one thing to do. So if you look at the units on K is going to be
do it fast, and I'm rapidly running out of time here. The units on K goes as newtons meter squared per coulomb squared. The units on lambda is coulombs per meter. L, this is meters, that's meters. So I have meters times meters, and down here I have meters cubed. So if I did that right, it should all cancel. I'm trying to do this in a hurry. It should work. So in the end, you should get newtons per coulomb. And I may have made a mistake. I'll clean it up in my notes. Okay. How else do you know if you're right? You look at this and you think about, what can I change in this problem where I just simply know what the right answer is? Okay? If I go very far away, z becomes infinitely large. Okay? Then I know that this looks like just 1 over r squared 4. So it's coulomb. I'll be done in just a minute. Okay? Your class starts in 10 minutes. So, if I go to large z in that mathematical expression, it should simplify to q over r squared. Right? So you can do what I would call limiting cases, which you look at this thing, you look at the problem, you think, what can I make big or some dimension I can change where I just simply know what the answer has to be? And I look mathematically, I let it go to that limit, and I see if I get the right answer. It's extremely powerful. We call it limiting cases. So I'll come back and do this a little more carefully on Thursday.
You get too high of it.